The Gambling Files podcast presents Desert Island Discs with your host, John Bruford. Hello and welcome to a special edition of Desert Island Discs. I say special, but they're all special, really, because you're all special. I'm your host, John Bruford. There are no sponsors on this podcast, so I don't have to read out any messages, but sponsorships are available. I'm joined this episode by Jessica Wellman. Jessica, did I get your name right?
Yes.
Super.
It's not that difficult, thankfully.
No, but that doesn't mean I'm going to get it right. Jessica is the Deputy Director for the Campaign for Fairer Gambling. Recently joined that, formerly...
SBC. I was the Managing Editor of SBC Media when I left.
There you go. And that is quite a fancy title. So I'm sure many of you listening will already know who Jessica is. Jessica, welcome.
Hello.
Hi. Now, I contacted you to come on the podcast or to come on a podcast because I said, like, look, we've got three and you could actually come on all three potentially. But I think we'll probably do two. But you never know because we're just wild and crazy and we just, you know, that's how we roll. Do you know what I mean? There are no fucking rules here.
All right.
And I just emphasize that by swearing in it.
Just I know, I was like, all right, we've set the bar. I know exactly what's...
In a good horror movie, they will have a moment that says to you...
We're for real.
You think you know the rules, you don't.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And I think A Quiet Place does that really fantastically well, with one of the kids dying right at the start.
But also, like, I could go off on this movie for a while. Like, worst parents ever. Who's like, oh, let's have Timmy the toddler bring up the rear. That's a great idea.
Hey, you're preaching to the choir. However, you are right. And also, getting your missus up the duff and there's fucking face-eating aliens around.
Yeah, like...
Because I'm pretty sure that's post-invasion, the up the
duff. Oh, yeah, and they're, I mean...
Go find some quiet condoms.
Yeah.
I don't remember seeing any Catholic iconography in there. There were no hair shirts or anything, so...
No, I got out of that movie and said, it's rare that I am, like, rooting for the characters to die, but I was just like, you've made endless terrible decisions that you kind of have what's coming to you.
I do it all the time. I'm one of those people who's like, oh, I hope they get their face eaten.
I mean, but, like, yeah, the bad guy or whatever. You're not supposed to want Emily Blunt to die in this movie. And I'm like, no, I'm good with it.
Yeah, did you see was it a prequel, Quiet Place,
Day Yes, One? I did watch. That was actually, I thought that was more interesting than the first
one. I thought it was very, very good, very nicely done. But we're getting sidetracked already. Sidetracking.
This is why I wanted to do this podcast of the three, though, because talking about movies is a passion.
Sidetracking comes later. I've never, on this podcast, I've never been judgmental about anybody's movie choices. And anybody that says I have is a liar and a communist. Unless you choose The Greatest Showman, in which case, fuck you and your family.
Yeah. I'm with you on that one. So far we're aligned. This is good. Because I know when it comes to music that I'm going to embarrass myself.
Great.
So.
We've all got skeletons in the closet. So, for anybody that's new to this, the idea is that Jessica is washed up on a tropical island, and that's a tropical island, it is not a desert island, and she is able to choose some things to keep her company and keep her sane while she's there. She's going to choose three books, three albums, three movies, one song that's not on the albums, one pet from any time in her life, one object... one dessert, and two pieces of advice. So, let's start with books.
All right. So, I want you to know I've taken this assignment very literally, and I'm thinking about, like, with all of my cultural consumption, it is very mood influenced, you know, like after a breakup, I want to lean into like heavy, sad stuff and things like that. So I'm trying to cover bases versus just like top three favorites.
Okay.
For books, I'm going to start with my favorite author, or writer rather, author's not quite right, is Chuck Klosterman. If you're familiar with him, he's a pop culture writer.
I'm pretty sure you just made his name up. Chuck Klosterman.
Yeah, so he's kind of like our Nick Hornby.
Okay.
He had a book when I was in college called Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs that was a series of essays.
Okay.
I basically have that one committed to memory, that I don't need to keep that book with me. But he has relatively, in the past 10 years, recent one about the 90s. Essays about pop culture of the 90s. So I would bring Chuck Klosterman's The 90s, because I've got to have something from him. I'm big into memoirs. And one of my other favorite authors is Dave Eggers.
Okay, you're going to say A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius.
Yes.
Now, the thing that I always loved about that book is the chapter about Mr. T.
I don't even remember. I discover new things. I revisit it like every 3 years or so, and I forget kind of what's in there.
It is a nicely written book.
Well, and also, I am someone who, I wasn't 20 by the time both of my parents died, but I'm younger by comparison. Both of my parents were gone by the time I was 32. So just like the adult orphan thing of it all, it's kind of just nice to have somebody who talks about that experience. Mm. And then the third one...
Hang on, we're not done.
Oh.
So Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius came out, if I remember right, I was about 2000. 25.
I think is when it...
Yeah, I was 25 in 2000, yeah. So that works. I was living in London, and pretty much every writer I knew, all of the women certainly, were absolutely raving about it. But it's really fascinating to look back on it now and think, holy shit, that fucker's made some great movies.
The Circle, not a great movie, amazing book.
Okay.
I'm
talking about his little brother.
Oh, Tove?
No. I'm talking about Robert Eggers.
Oh, okay. Okay.
No. Everybody that I knew in London was reading it and talking about it and all of that. And it's really unusual for a book to kind of penetrate an age group so quickly and so perfectly. And this is, it's not pre-internet, but it's pre-fucking social media and all that jazz, pretty much. And it was quite extraordinary, especially because as a book, it's really, really American.
It is also, it's very, very Gen X. Like, I'm on the older, I'm technically a millennial, but like, I don't none of the traits of a millennial really apply. I'm very much Gen X in kind of how I was raised. That I'm kind of curious, like, if you had Gen Z read this book, I feel like they're going to hate it.
Yeah, I just think it's really dull.
Well, it's also just, you know, there was that, and there's an essay about this in the Chuck Klosterman one, too, that the whole thing about Gen X is like, damn the man. I don't want to be part of this, like, corporate culture. And instead, the generations behind them are like, you're going to be a part of it, but the great news is you're a brand that you get to control, which, like, to a Gen X aged person like yourself, I assume, like me, is, like, horrifying.
I've just had to check if I'm Gen X, and I am. Thanks.
Well, you said 25 in 2000, so I was able to just do the math on this.
Yeah,
one.
It's just, I'm just in a box now.
But yeah, no, there, like, I have definitely picked two extremely American writers, which doesn't surprise me, because my SBC peers would be like, you are really American. And I'm like,
well,
yeah.
You've got the accent. But there is more to Americanness than that, definitely. I'm going to have to look up Chuck Klosterman just to see if he's real.
Start with sex, drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, because there's an essay in there that if you... I mean, we'll get to the music thing. My favorite essay in there is in response to that whole, like, Tipper Gore era of the music and the video games are turning all the children into Satanists.
Yep.
And he's like, the real problem with today's society is John Cusack and Coldplay. Because John Cusack films and Coldplay music create this absolutely ridiculous idea of what love should be. And everybody's ending up, like, depressed and mentally distressed because their relationships aren't John Cusack outside the window with the boombox.
Yeah, but my brain initially didn't go to fucking say anything. My brain went straight to The Sure Thing.
Oh, okay. That's a deeper cut.
That's a far better film. I get the idea, but I don't think you can lay it at the feet of John Cusack. I think that route goes back much, much further.
Oh, for sure. But again, of the Gen X era, like,
yeah.
Women might... The John Cusack romantic hero was, like, in your head when you're 17, 20, well, my boyfriend should be, like, behaving like this. Where's my boombox?
Interesting that you say that you mentioned that, though, because, of course, Cusack was in the movie of High Fidelity, and you mentioned Nick Hornby.
Oh, I love earlier. Nick Hornby. I have all of his stuff, including his volumes from The Believer, his weekly or monthly what I've been reading.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
I'm a completist. Like, if I find a writer I like, I really love, I will own everything.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, Hornby for a while was everywhere in the UK, and he's I'm not going to say he's gone off the boil a bit. I just probably forgot about him. But he's got a great name. I think Hornby is actually an innately funny name. Okay, so we've got Chuck Closeman. We've got Dave Eggers. Just making a note. I'm not going to write the whole title. I'm just going to write Heartbreaking Work, which takes a while by itself.
Yeah.
Number three. What's your third book? What is it?
So most of my friends were required to read this in high school, which is just kind of a death sentence for a book.
Yeah.
I was not required to read it, and I loved it. I'm going to guess you haven't heard of this one, because it's very American, too. A Separate Piece by John Knowles.
You are quite correct. But I know the name John Knowles.
The book is essentially World War II era boarding school, you know, like East Coast posh boarding school. And there's kind of two boys. There's one who is really smart, but a little shy and still kind of awkward about himself. And his best friend, who is extremely charismatic and athletic. And it's just a look at friendship where there sometimes can be jealousy in friendship. You know?
Yeah, of course.
Where this guy's sitting there like...
Can you imagine how my friends feel being friends with me?
It would be tough.
Those poor fucks.
Oh, man. The bar is so high. So it's this Gene, the main character, the shyer one, is grappling with the fact that, like, he feels like he's doing everything he's supposed to, that his best friend breaks the rules and never gets in trouble. And those feelings kind of boil over into an incident that I can't go into for spoiler reasons. And... Okay. So I just think it's a really beautiful story about kind of friendship and the insecurity of being, I mean, I think even now I would say a young person, but at 42, I still can feel that insecurity sometimes of like, what have these people figured out that I haven't?
Yeah. I had an epiphany at the age of 16 when I realized that everybody was winging it. And I think 16 is probably unusually young to have that epiphany, but I had it and it's stuck.
But see, and then I have the resentment of, I do what I planned, I prepared. Like, you know, why is this?
I have a friend who did that as well. And she achieved not all of her dreams, but she achieved most of her significant life goals by about the age of 25. And I'm just like, what are you going to do now? She's like,
No, I mean, I was that kid that anytime I misbehaved in the slightest, which was rare, I would always get caught and I would always get in trouble.
I fucked around all the time.
Oh, no.
which will shock listeners to this podcast. No, it's interesting. When I was at school, the national curriculum, it alternated two books. My sister is 4 years older than me, so they must have messed with the curriculum, I think. But she got to read The Outsiders, which I still to this day absolutely love, and I recently read it to my kids. They're 3 and 5.
Just voices that you're like, be cool, soda pop.
Daddy, what's knife crime? Well, son. No, they're not really. They're 13, 11, and 8. But they loved it. They absolutely loved it. And Lord of the Flies.
I just started watching the British
remake. It had great reviews, I think.
I hate it so far, I'll be honest.
Okay. I've not watched it, but I don't really feel a need to watch it because the book's fucking amazing.
The book's amazing. And like, it's one you just, nobody seems to get the adaptation right. You know, like the black and white one from back in the day wasn't great. They did one in the 90s with Balthazar Getty.
They did, yeah.
Which wasn't great. This one, I'm very happy to see representation on film. It is like the United Colors of Benetton crash on this plane. In 1954, this boarding school filled with, like, mixed-race children, and nobody's talking about the fact that, like, you know, there are race hierarchies at play in 1954 that the color blindness of it all just is pissing me off.
Yeah, it's a funny one because when a story is firmly of an era and the era and its specificities play a part, fucking around with that fucks around with all of the plot dynamics.
Yeah.
So I'll probably give that one a miss.
Yeah, if that stuff bothers you.
Generally, like, colorblind casting doesn't particularly bother me. I don't mind
if it doesn't matter.
But if you're going to do that, move the story.
Yeah.
And do something with it. Don't try and tell the same story with a completely different dynamic.
Agreed.
You have to bring a new dynamic in. The story on its own needs that underpinning. I remember when I was at sixth form, we went to see, do you know the play Blood Wedding?
I've heard of it.
It's Gabriel García Lorca, if I remember right. Spanish playwright. Pretty batshit. Shared a house with Buñuel and Dali.
Oh, God.
Fucking hell. I would love to have been a fly on that particular wall. My God, the drugs.
I was going to say the drug trips had to have been insane.
But, Buñuel wrote this play, and it's all set in sort of rural Spain, and it's very Spanish. So I went to see an adaptation of it that put it on some kind of huge African plantation, which didn't work.
No.
Because all of the dynamics of the story are really, really Spanish.
In high school, I was in a musical production of West Side Story, in which I played a shark.
Okay.
It was kind of colorblind casting, and it was like Tony was played by a black guy, Maria was played by a white girl, Bernardo and Anita were played by black people, Riff was played by a white person. None of it made any sense. It was the worst play. My mom would go see every show time of every musical I was in. After one, this was the first play, she was like, do I have to come back?
That sounds good. You've just reminded me, this is a really bizarre thought to have, and it's absolutely not related to anything we've talked about so far apart from West Side Story, that one of the Bring It On sequels has a really fantastic little homage to West Side Story in it.
It's a great film. It was in the running for my choices here today.
The Robert Wise one?
Yes. Oh, God, not the Spielberg one? Absolutely not. No, that was...
If you want to talk about directors with a purple patch, I'm not sure Robert Wise can be topped.
Oh, I love Robert Wise movies.
What's not to love?
What's the one, No Way Out? Is that the one where Sidney Poitier's the doctor? And the white hooligans are in the hospital?
Hang on.
There's a Robert Wise, Sidney Poitier movies that I'm obsessed with.
Is The only No Way Out I can think of is the Costner one.
I'm really big into old shit, so.
1950. Sidney Poitier film debut, directed by Joseph Mankiewicz.
Oh, okay. That's what it is.
But the Costner No Way Out is fantastic.
We're going to get to Kevin Costner.
That probably means... Yeah. Okay. So we've done three books. Let's get embarrassing before you have the opportunity for redemption.
Yeah.
Three albums.
So I'm the rare person that will admit I don't have good taste in music. I know that about myself. It's very eclectic.
But it's yours.
Feel like many people don't realize they don't have great taste. They think they're have. I have no. About music to be like.
But you say to people, like, what kind of music do you like? Oh, anything good. What the fuck does that mean?
Oh, no. My pet peeve is, what kind of music do you like? Anything but country. And I'm like, really? You listen to Native American flute, Chinese atonal opera? Like, it's just like a virtue signal that bothers me.
Also, they're completely wiping out Johnny Cash there. And Laura Cantrell.
There are a lot of good country artists.
Well, let's not go too far.
Okay, so, again, utility. Generally with music, I need to just, like, wallow in my feelings. I need something just, like, to dance around to while I get ready for the day or do, like, menial chores. And I assume being stranded on an island, menial chores is a big part of the day.
Yeah, your basics are taken care of. You've got
But, like, you
got
to chop wood, pick, you know, coconuts, that kind of thing. So, we're going to go with the soundtrack to Hamilton, because it's kind of like a twofer, right? I get the full show, because it's a sung-through musical, but there's also just, like, really amazing songs within the soundtrack for Hamilton.
Okay. I've not seen it, and I've not heard it. My daughter is actually...
Again, I'm just picking the most American things about it.
That is really American. My daughter will talk about Lin-Manuel Miranda all day. I think she's fascinated by him, but I'm not sure that she could speak confidently about anything he's done. But I think she just likes the idea that Lin-Manuel Miranda exists. right, a while ago, a couple of years ago, I was sitting around and I was watching The Warriors, right? And I'm sitting watching it, and I thought to myself two things. I thought, holy shit, I think this is the first time I've watched it in one chunk.
Okay.
And then I'm thinking, this is a really good movie. But it's basically a musical. I mean, it's structured just like a musical. Yeah. And I wonder if it was a musical previously or was intended to be a musical. And I wonder if anybody's adapted it. So I look it up, and Lin-Manuel Miranda...
is making a musical out of it?
Yeah.
Of course.
And it's been... he's done it now. I don't know whether it had any life, but changed it to an all-female gang, which is a bit odd.
I mean, okay. Hamilton as a concept for a... that's what I kind of love about Broadway, is, like, you can get some stuff made that you can't get made as, like, a movie or a television show.
You're speaking to an English person... We created Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Oh, and thank you for that.
I mean, who the fuck thought Cats up?
Like, Cats is... I mean, again, yeah, like, listen, no, there's no real story. It's just kind of a tone poem about cats.
Yeah. I'm not...
I'm a theater nerd, so I have to get my musical theater nerdness in there. Honestly, this one was hard, because I am a... person that, like, with the advent of shuffle and playlists, I just don't listen to albums
really. Yeah, this is difficult, and I think anybody below 30 is going to really struggle with this.
But even when I had, when, like, the CD era, there was always kind of tracks I'd skip or I didn't really like, or I'd only like three or four, so I had to really think about what's one that I can just listen to straight through and I never skip one, and it would be Ben Folds' Rockin' the Suburbs.
Was this just Ben Folds, or is it Ben Folds
It is
five?
His first solo album.
Okay. Okay, so Ben
Who Folds. Makes some music with Nick Hornby from time to time.
Okay. What's the name of the album again?
Rock in the Suburbs. Again, just such a... I'm feeling so American today. Just like all of these concepts are. Well, this is one that, like, as you listen through these, it's one of those that, like, an album that could very easily be a musical. There's a lot of, like, songs with names in them that I'm like,
okay.
I had to drive out for college. I would be driving from Kentucky to LA every summer and back. And so, one summer, it was my friend and I were like, we created the musical in our head of like, this song will go here and this song will go here, and the things you do when you're driving for 3 days straight.
Yeah, things you do with time on your hands. I've always said boredom is the key driver for creativity, but that doesn't always mean it's a good thing.
No, I don't think this musical should see the light of day. But yeah, like, I love an earnest dude with a piano, so Ben Folds.
Well, I mean, America has a long history of earnest men with pianos.
Yeah, like Andrew McMahon, I have seen live more than any other artist. If you're familiar with Jack's Mannequin, Something Corporate, those bands.
I'm pretty sure you're making these up now. This is like you've just put into ChatGPT, make up some artist and album names for me to bamboozle some.
No, like I was an emo kid in college, so... Okay. I liked, like, Jimmy Eat World, Ben Folds, Dashboard Confessional.
I bet, his name's gone out of my head now, I've just thought of it. Elliot, come on.
Smith?
Yes. How can I forget the surname Smith? Fuck me. But I bet Elliot Smith was in there. Was he in your playlist?
No, he was, like, a little more... He was very earnest and sad,
yeah,
but, like,
was.
Not as whiny about it as the people that I listen to. Like, my musical taste kind of, I would listen and pick up new artists up until about college graduation, and now it's very rare for me to, like, find a new band and get into them. I think Haim is, I always said Haim, but apparently I'm pronouncing it wrong. The Three Sisters.
Well, I'm not going to call him Corey Haim, for fuck's sake. Why would you do that?
No, but they're Jewish, and so it's like an Israeli pronunciation.
Well, okay, I'm sure Israeli people can pronounce it correctly.
Yeah, I don't know.
In Italy, they call the city Roma. I'm still going to call it Rome.
The town I grew up, the town next to my hometown in Kentucky, is spelled V-E-R-S-A-I-L-L-E-S.
Okay.
It is pronounced Versailles.
Of course it is. Mind you, I live near Leominster. Which is Leominster.
Oh, yeah, Leominster is the rest of us would guess.
And I'm quite close to Clibbury Mortimer, Cleobury, etc. And one of my favorites is when you get American tourists in Ludlow, they're like, excuse me, can you tell me how to find Onibury? Onibury? Yeah, but that's, you know, the vagaries of the English language and English place names. I also live quite close to Lord Hereford's Knob.
Oh.
Yeah.
True story.
I've never seen it, I'm glad to say.
that's a different kind of podcast.
It really is.
Okay, this last one is embarrassing, but like I said, I need a bunch of like fun dance songs. I danced all through childhood. I started taking ballet when I was 2. I still take dance classes now just to like as a hobby. There was a compilation series in the 90s that would, you know, was this a thing in Britain at all, where they would be like, they'd scroll the track listings in the TV ad and be like, you know, love song or like real love, and it's like a 2 CD compilation of all the best, all the random one hit wonder love hits of the 90s or something.
We did have those, but they didn't do the type of ad you mean.
It's kind of like now that's what I call music. Yeah.
But they never did that. It'd just be like, oh, it's got some of these on.
So there was a now that's what I call music like series called Pure Disco.
I like it already.
So Pure Disco Volume 1, I'm just going to read these titles really fast. You get YMCA, Celebration, Dancing Queen, Hot Stuff, I Will Survive, You're the First, the Last, My Everything, I Need Your Lovin', Knock on Wood, I Love the Nightlife, Flashback, That's the Way I Like It, Best Disco in Town, If I Can't Have You, Oops Upside Your Head by the Gap Band, which if you're not familiar, love the Gap Band. Love Hangover, Cuba, Funky Town, Got to Give It Up, Don't Leave Me This Way, I Feel Love, and as a at an added bonus, you get from Greece, You're the One That I Want.
Wow.
So yeah, I was just like, bang for my buck. I'm getting all the variety. I'm going to dance to all of these. And given this is what I'm primarily going to be listening to as I do menial chores all day.
Okay.
It sounds stupid on the surface, but I think there's reasoning behind it.
Some people are so when we're recording this, some people are slightly, I'm not going to say puritanical, but slightly, some people refuse to choose compilations.
Oh, but, was that a rule?
No, oh, it's okay. Not a rule at all. It's not a rule at all. It's up to you. Oops Upside Your Head, when that used to come on in our local nightclub when I was a kid, people would, I don't know if they did this in the States, but they sit on the floor and dance.
What?
In a long line.
Oh, this sounds fun.
It's fucking bonkers. And that might just be in my town.
We did, I've asked people from every state because this was a thing at our local roller rink. There was this one song and the roller rink DJ would at periodic times for the song say, Gator. And you had to roll, like, so dangerous. Don't know how people didn't get hurt. You just have to, like, bring yourself to a stop as fast as possible, lay on your back, and kick your hands and feet in the air.
Okay.
I've never encountered another person outside of Lexington, Kentucky, who ever did this, which is probably good. It's a really dangerous idea, but I don't know where it came from.
Yeah, that is really strange. In the UK, though, the same movement would be called the dying fly.
Oh, more accurate, for sure.
It's a relic from a children's TV show. In fact, it may have been one of the first Saturday morning children's TV shows on British television. Started in the, I think, early 1970s. It was called Tiz Was. Today is Saturday, Wear a Smile.
Oh.
It's crazy. Launched many careers. Okay, so we've got three albums. We've got three books. What does that leave? What's your first movie?
We're going to go with All About Eve from 1950.
Wow.
To me, the 40s and 50s are the best era of filmmaking. Followed by the 90s. Movies of today, every movie I see today, it just is a given that there's 30 minutes that didn't need to be there.
Okay.
Everything's too long.
Yeah, I'm very selective. Any movie over 2 hours now, I'm just like, yeah, maybe not. One of the reasons I love horror movies so much is they
tend to keep it the tight 90 minutes, you know? What was, The Substance was one where I was like, what is this 20 minutes at the end?
Yeah, The Substance was a really odd movie, and it was one of those films where it's a horror movie for people that have never seen a horror movie before. Because like, people say, oh my God, it's shocking, it's so fresh, it's so original. I went to see it with a couple of friends who've seen as many horror movies as I have, and we all came out and said, well, I've seen all that before.
I mean, like, I enjoy, like, it's a body horror movie, you know?
If Demi Moore hadn't been so fabulous and so fearless in it, nobody would have given it a second glance.
But to me, the final, like, attack, act, set, it just goes on and on and on.
And it's not particularly shocking. It's not particularly amusing.
But I looked at the running time on it when I was starting, and I was like, this feels long for a horror movie. And I was like, well, now I know why. There's this thing tacked onto the end for no real reason.
Yeah,
if you've seen a Cronenberg movie, this isn't anything new.
No, and he almost certainly did it better. And I mean, almost any Cronenberg movie.
Have you seen All About Eve?
I'm just sitting here racking my brains, and all I keep thinking about is the band that named itself after the film.
No, so it's Bette Davis, who's incredible. But it's a really great cast, too. You've got George Sanders, Celeste Holm, Ann Baxter. All of these people have been nominated for won Oscars. George Sanders won for this role.
Okay.
And it's, again, it's theater, but this woman is, Bette Davis is an aging star, and this woman kind of is like an Uber fan and works her way into her life and then slowly takes it over, like single white female back before that was a thing. But it's an ensemble, so you can really, it's rewatchable just in general, but you can rewatch it so many, and watch it from every character's point of view, and you're going to get a different kind of experience out of it. So just for razor sharp dialogue, good performances, and it's going to feel, I can be like, oh, today I'm going to watch from like the George Sanders angle, and today I'm going to watch, it's very rewatchable.
That's very interesting. And yeah, I totally get you. It's, there was, you know, name's gone completely out. I am a little bit jet lagged. I'm very sorry.
Yeah, that's fair.
William Goldman's first memoir,
Adventures in
Screen Trade.
Oh, he's so good.
And he opens it with the line, "Nobody in the film industry knows anything."
Correct.
But I think that holds true for the entire history of cinema. I don't think he. It's usually specifically said about the 1970s.
Yeah.
But I think you can say that about any period in film. Because there were people who were passed up by one studio, picked up by another, went on to become major stars. There were, you know, Casablanca, for example, and starting out as an afterthought almost.
Yeah.
And, you know, so many supporting pictures were made, etc., etc. And occasionally there was a visionary. I only found out recently that Psycho changed how films were shown.
Oh, and yeah, you used to be able to just come in whenever, and you can't because of Psycho, yeah.
I think that's a tremendous story. But occasionally there's this, there is a reason for a vision. And Robert Evans, I think, is a great example of a visionary. I'm not saying that he was all good, because he definitely wasn't, but...
Well, it's like people rag on the studio system a lot because there was that kind of rigidity, right? But... what was kind of great about it is that you had just this, you know, at MGM, it's just like, okay, well, Edith Head's going to do the costumes of all of these movies, and she's going to do like 20 a year versus I'm the costume designer for Wes Anderson, and that's the only thing that I do.
Yeah.
You know, so you just, the access to talent and the people under contract, because you're right, like, you know, because it's like, Bette Davis did well at Warner Brothers because she was great at like working class kind of movies back in the 30s. And then she switches over to MGM and does more of these like prestige pictures, because that's, you can tell I'm a really big old movie nerd. Switches to these
You're
like
the
prestige
right
movies as she's getting older. And it was, you had to find the right fit, you know?
But you also had directors who were just filmmakers. Whatever the film was, whatever the story
just give,
was.
They were journeymen, you know?
And like talking about Robert Wise, that purple patch of Robert Wise's. Think of the variety.
Well, that John Ford,
and,
you know?
But to nail those stories as well. It's not just he made some quite good films. He made genre-defining films in genres he'd never gone anywhere near before, because he just understood a story.
Yeah.
And... yeah, John Ford's a great example.
No, so
Houston's a great example. And they just understood how to tell a story.
So All About Eve is Joe Mankiewicz.
Okay.
I get frustrated because he gets the bad guy narrative because everybody worships Citizen Kane, you know, and his brother. And I'm just like, I would take the Joe Mankiewicz oeuvre over his brother's 100% of the time.
Well, you know. There's this weird thing where if somebody likes one thing more than they like another thing, that negates any of the good in the other thing.
Yeah.
As opposed to, they can both be good, you just prefer that one.
Yeah.
That's fine. Yeah, it doesn't make that thing shit just because you think that thing's better. And I do like Citizen Kane.
I do, but like when people now watch it, they're like, I don't understand. I was like, you have to place it in its
context is everything.
Historical importance. I was like, these like low angle shots and stuff that they technically stole from the Nazis, but like you hadn't really seen that before.
Everybody stole them.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, I'm saying
of visionaries. There's one.
Lenny Riefenstahl. I have this discussion with film school people a lot now because there's so much of this. And it's, I mean, that's a whole, you could do a podcast for years on this of just, do you teach Lenny Riefenstahl? I learned Lenny Riefenstahl in film school.
Yeah, 100%.
And there are people who say no. They're like, it's important, like, you cannot... you know, loud somebody with that ideology. I was like, how can you not? She's a genius.
Absolute genius.
Like, she's a sinister genius, but she's objectively a genius.
But you don't have to discuss her ideology or what she's
you
presenting.
Can.
You are really, the root of it is discussing how she presented it. It's how she formed visual language. And it's extraordinary.
So yeah, there are people, the people who just write off, like, you should never watch Triumph of the Will. I'm like, you're crazy. Like, do I hope that you don't ideologically take away ideas from Triumph of the Will? Sure. But like, to watch what she does in these propaganda movies and see how much it influences how movies are made today is just such a seminal part of what I learned that it's just crazy. I'm always interested to hear the other side of it, of like the argument why you shouldn't teach her.
Yeah, I don't hold with that, and I think there's a real.
They say this about like John Wayne and John Ford, and I'm like, you're taking the ideology of today and expecting people from the 40s to aspire to it, and that's just a fundamentally flawed approach.
Yeah, there's also the as you touched on a minute ago, the art and artist, you know, I'm not particularly a fan of Picasso, but the guy was, by most metrics, even at the time, a prick. It doesn't mean he wasn't influential, and it doesn't mean his art wasn't important. An awful lot of artists are absolute pricks.
Have you seen Tar with Kate Winslet or Kate Blanchett?
I haven't. It was on the plane on the way over, so I didn't watch
it. Has a great scene in this with like young students who are like, well, you know, we don't really want to glorify Bach. Because, you know, he had women personal life issues or whatever. She goes into this amazing monologue. It's the best part of the movie.
Okay. I might have to watch it then because I think...
It's way too long, but there's some delightful spots in there.
Suites for Cello and Violoncello is one of the greatest things I've ever heard. The Pablo Casals recording is just... God, it fucking melts me. In fact, the lady that did the music for the other two podcasts... bought me that from the EMI Masters collection. I went in to buy Hot Buttered Soul by Isaac Hayes.
And left with Bach.
Left with Bach, yeah.
That's amazing.
But one of the things I love most about that specific recording, the Pablo Casals recording, is that when they came to do the EMI Masters series, it's number one in the series, and they basically recognized that there was already a perfect recording of it. And so they recorded it from the vinyl. So when you put the CD on or the MP3 or whatever, you get the crackle and hiss of the record. It's absolutely gorgeous. Just divine. Yes, the art and artist argument is just... It's an emotive thing.
Yeah.
It's like, what, do we not watch Kevin Spacey movies anymore?
Well, I have no objection to... Like, I listen to a lot less Michael Jackson than I used to because I get kind of hinky feelings about it. So it's like, I understand if it's just like, as a personal choice, I don't find this enjoyable because I cannot divorce the two. I think that's perfectly valid. Yeah, it's so when it's like, what should we be teaching people that I start to get a little frustrated.
Yeah, teaching should be as broad as it can possibly be, because otherwise we're just going to create a generation of fucking idiots. Interestingly, the Michael Jackson thing, bear with me here because this is going to sound bad. Oh, that's not a pun, by the way. But I listen to more Michael Jackson now than I used to.
Really?
I do, but it's not anything to do with him being a nonce or not being a nonce or whatever went down. It's, I watched the documentary about the making of We Are the World.
Okay.
In which I don't seem to remember them mentioning the British Band-Aid single at all. oddly. And it's a terrific documentary, and I really, really enjoyed it. But it's Quincy Jones, who's not going to listen to Quincy Jones when he's talking, fucking hell. So he's talking about how Michael Jackson writes songs, or wrote songs. And I had no idea. I had no idea that he didn't know how to write music at all, didn't know how to read music. He would get a cassette player, he'd get two cassette players, sorry, and he would make the noises that he wanted. And then to add a layer, he'd play that one back
and then do
while
something.
Making the next noise and create this layered recording to create what he wanted. Give that to the producer and say, could you make that happen? And actually that made me look at Billie Jean particularly and think, this arrived in his head fully formed. And he just had to find a way to get it out there to somebody, a Quincy Jones. I think it was Quincy Jones that produced Thriller. To be able to express this thing. And I think that's fascinating. But my favorite thing about the documentary was it's all these fucking huge egos in this room, and they're all tired because it was recorded right after the Grammys in 1985 or whatever. And apparently nobody asked anybody else for an autograph until Diana Ross did. And it blew my mind who she went up to. Diana Ross went up to Daryl Hall and said, I'm a huge fan, could you please sign this for me? Like, if I'm Daryl Hall in that moment, I'd say, do you not know that you're Diana Ross? And I am not worth the steam off your piss. I'm not dissing Daryl Hall.
I think the average person would agree the hierarchy here is.
Yeah, fucking hell. I mean, come on, Diana. Sort yourself out, love. Okay, so we've got All About Eve, and it's a compelling description for why you want it. What's next?
It's a Wonderful Life.
Wow. Okay. Do you know, I think you're the first person that's chosen that.
So this is, like, yeah, it's the Christmas, New Year's tradition for a lot of people, but I'm a big Jimmy Stewart fan in general. But also this one is just, it's a good... When I'm in, like, a negative headspace, it's always a good recenterer for me.
Okay.
To remind myself, like, as I've mentioned, I'm getting overly personal here, but, like, my parents died. I was 9 when my dad died. I was 32 when my mom died. I have one sibling. So I can sometimes feel like I'm a little alone on an island. And this is always a nice thing to watch to remind me that I'm not as aware sometimes of how I'm impacting and influencing people.
No, it's a fabulous description of it. Thing that always gets me about It's a Wonderful Life, I've seen it 2 years in a row at the cinema. And it's always a lovely experience. And I went this Christmas, just gone with my significant other. And it was lovely. It's just a really, really nice experience. But for the time, it's a long film.
A little bit, yeah.
It's an unusually long film.
Well, and when it came out, nobody went to see it. Yeah. It was a huge flop.
But, you know, that does happen. I mean, so often, the really great films.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, we could make a fucking massive and possibly quite comprehensive list of films that were totally ignored.
Yeah.
And It's a Wonderful Life might be, you know,
it's either like that or Shawshank, I think, are the ones that the life they take on.
I think Blade Runner and The Thing are big ones as well.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, there's also that little subset of films where it's all about word of mouth. And as much as I dislike intensely The Greatest Showman, because it is one of the worst box-ticking films I've ever seen.
I'm not... Yeah, I have a lot of musical friends that love this, and I'm just like, I can't.
It...
That was a word-of-mouth one.
That's the thing. It's because it's word-of-mouth, I actually have some respect for it. And I think word-of-mouth is a big deal. My favorite word-of-mouth hit story is Twins.
Okay.
Because Twins did fuck all when it came out. And it just grew and grew and grew. Did you know that, let me think what year this would be. It would be, fucking hell, 94? Something like that? 1994 maybe-ish? I'm not sure. But it came out in the summer of, I think it was in the summer. Might have been in the autumn. Anyway. And the run just kept getting extended and extended, and theatres added.
Yeah.
So it had this big wide opening. Nobody went to see it. The numbers dropped off. And then people start coming back, and the per theatre average goes up and up. And that's the key. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it was actually in the top 10 grossing movies for two consecutive years.
Oh.
That's how long its tail was.
I love looking at top 10 grossing of like the 80s and 90s because you're just reminded. Decade,
it's extraordinary how many of those films are forgotten.
Those especially. Well, I mean, I think like, you know, 2000 onward, it's pretty boring. It's 10 action movies and or it's action in children's movies.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of dull. But like you look at like Good Morning Vietnam was one of the top 10 grossing when it came out. And that would just not happen in today's environment.
No, it wouldn't. But no, as bizarre as this sounds, its poster wouldn't happen either. You know, it's Robin Williams, big face and a microphone, and he's got a big smile.
The American flag in the background, yeah.
It would not be marketed like that. There would be no reason to market it like that. How things have changed. Shit. Yeah, don't get me started on that.
No, like, I miss the mid-range, like, because, like, my favorite genre is, like, courtroom dramas and things like that. And they, you don't get those, like, you get them on Netflix now, or they end up being TV series that are 7 episodes too long because it should have been a movie.
Yeah, I've got a theory about courtroom dramas, right? And I'm tying this into an article that I'm working on at the moment.
Okay.
Because it's about, I'm not going to mention what the article's about. But there is a world of difference between how lawyers are represented pre-John Grisham and post-John Grisham.
Oh, interesting.
Like, can you name, I don't know, and as an aficionado of the genre, movies that had lawyers as heroes pre, let's say, 1990.
My favorite film of all time.
But it's a different kind of lawyer hero.
Yeah, he's like a flawed hero.
What's your...
Witness for the Prosecution.
Okay. So you've got, like, there's The Verdict. You've got Witness for the Prosecution. There are really good quality movies, but they're big...
To Kill a Mockingbird?
They're big, weighty movies.
Yeah.
They've got big subjects, big themes.
Yeah.
As opposed to post-Grisham, where the fucking lawyer is almost an action hero.
Yeah.
Etc. And it's a massive shift, and I think that what John Grisham has shown us, and I fucking hate John Grisham. I fucking hate his books. He's a shit awful writer. I don't care what anybody says. He's a fucking hack. He writes thrillers that have no thrills. For fuck's sake, make an effort,
Some
John.
Of those movies are good, though. The Client, that's a great movie.
It's a good movie. Runaway Jury is a lot of fun. But the bulk of his... I did a little project... I decided to read John Grisham books until I found one that wasn't shit. I read 13 books.
And then you just gave up?
No, I found one that wasn't awful.
Which was?
It was the sequel to A Time to Kill, which was also not
That's
terrible.
A real random one.
But yeah, it took 13 books, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, Time to Kill's a good movie, too.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, and Matthew McConaughey has the market cornered on lawyer heroes. You know?
Yeah, he's done some great work there. But Samuel Jackson in A Time to Kill is phenomenal.
Oh, he's... Yeah.
He is fabulous. He is just pure fucking pain.
What is it? You're damn right I did, and I hope they burn in hell for it. Isn't that the line?
Yes, it is.
Oh, it's so good.
It is really, really good. But seriously, so, I think that the lawyer perception changed. I think what Grisham has shown us is how to affect generational change in perception. I honestly think that, and that's going to be the heart of an article.
So, I'm going to add on to this, and it ties into It's a Wonderful Life. I think, because I'm one of these people, you grow up watching the Capra idealized justice system. You know, Mr. Yeah. Smith goes to Washington. 12 Angry Men is another one. You know, justice prevails. And in my head, like, I am that person that there are lots of people who take issue with the American justice system. There are things wrong with it. But just, like, the idea of it is so pure to me that a lawyer, like, representing and defending that, just because I was brought up on all of this, you know, media that's telling me, you know, fight for justice, fight for fairness, et cetera, et cetera. It's not surprising at all that the heroes of the post-Grisham era, when I'm becoming an adult, are going to have kind of that at the heart of what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have an idealistic view of any justice system. It's more of a resignation, but I don't mean that in a bad way, or an acceptance that this is what we have. And if somebody has been away and they have done their time, and it was agreed by a jury yeah. or by a judge that that is their time served,
yeah.
then leave them the fuck alone after that. With caveats in some instances, obviously, but mostly, if that's what we've got, we either have to believe in it or you get inside the system and you change it.
Yeah.
But you don't just sit and
whine about it. Yeah, that's my complaint.
Okay, It's a Wonderful Life. I mean, if you'd asked me at the start, if you'd asked me after your books what your movies would be, I would have probably picked It's a Wonderful Life. And while I probably wouldn't have gotten All About Eve, I would have gone for something with Betty Davis.
I love Betty Davis. So I'll go down just like rabbit holes where I'll pull up their Letterboxd profile and be like, how many movies with this actor can I watch? And I just binge. So I've done this with like Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, Barbara Stanwyck was a recent one. Glenn Ford, love a Glenn Ford movie. Wow. Clint okay. Eastwood. Don't ask me. I ended up being like a much bigger Eastwood fan than I thought I would be because I love, again, the type of movie he made. An interesting adult movie that is not an action movie.
Eastwood, as a director, fits precisely into the 40s and 50s style of director, telling multiple different stories.
Yeah. Oh, he does also, I mean, like, not always successful.
No.
But, like, he's also one...
Usually interesting.
And this is, like, I wanted to be a producer when I went to film school, so I admire these traits that don't get talked about from an artistic perspective. Always on schedule, always under budget.
Yep.
Like, yeah. Matt Damon was telling a story about how he had, like, a big monologue, because he's done a few Clint Eastwood movies.
The story's about Invictus, isn't it?
Yes. And he does it the first time, and he's like, I got, like, 4 or 5 different other ways. And he's like, why would you waste our time when we've got it? And I was just like, I love that man.
My favorite Eastwood, both acting and directing, is Million Dollar Baby.
Oh, see, this is one of the few that I can't stand.
Have you read the book that it's from?
No.
It might be worth reading the book
okay.
and revisiting it, because while I'm not a great fan of Paul Haggis necessarily, I think he did an amazing job with that.
Yeah.
Because it's you know, a little bit like if you've read the book that Brokeback Mountain
yeah.
is from. It's probably the thinnest, weakest story in the collection.
Yeah.
And it's the same for Million Dollar Baby. It's the thinnest, weakest story. But it's so... Oh, fuck. Okay, right. So it's from a collection of short stories called Rope Burns by a writer. He's writing under a pseudonym. Pseudonym is FX Tool. And this guy... I'm going to get some of these details messed up, but he was like an insurance salesman or some shit. It's just some fucking shitty job. And he did his shitty job until his kids had finished college. And he said to his wife, I'm going to retrain and follow my passion. And he retrained as a cut man to work boxing corners, right?
Uh-huh.
Did that, was hugely passionate about it, and wrote this collection of short stories, okay. right? And it's a superb collection of stories. It's excellent. It's really quite unique. What Haggis did when he wrote the screenplay for Million Dollar Baby is he has taken characters from almost all of the stories
oh, okay.
to create the world and it's so beautifully immersive. And I think it would not have been the movie, because I went to see it at the cinema. I rocked up at the cinema and I thought, I'll just go see what's on next.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Million Dollar Baby, and I didn't know anything about it. It's one of the only times a film's ended and nobody got up to walk out. All you could hear was people sniffing in their seats.
So, I will say, story time. The best, the funniest movie, like movie-going experience of my life happened during Million Dollar Baby.
Okay.
So it's 2004 when this came out, right? So I'm in the theater. It's like a weeknight, I think. Like, there's not a lot of us in there. We're at the scene, right, where he's deciding what he's going to do for her.
Okay.
So you're just hearing the machine, and that's about it. Like, boop, shh, boop. Yeah. And out of nowhere in the theater, you hear, do-do-do-do, 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 do-do-do-do. And then this woman picks up, she answers the phone in the movie theater. And loud enough for everyone goes to hear. This is exactly what she said. She goes, "Hello? I can't talk. I'm at the picture show." I was just like, the fact she called it the picture show, the fact that she answered, the fact it was the old Nokia ringtone, the fact that it happened at like the pivotal moment of the movie.
It's too perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad I wasn't there.
Oh, you would have just lost it, huh?
Oh.
I could, how do you hate someone who calls it the picture show?
There is that. But I quite recently, actually, somebody was just completely dicking around behind me. I can't remember what the movie was. And I just turned around and I just said, "Would you mind just shutting the fuck up?" And I said it really politely. I went very, very English. "Excuse me, old chap, would you mind fucking off?" And that was quite funny. And it was two teenage girls, and they went and sat back next to their mum. And when they finished, there was lots of pointing and gesturing towards me. And I just stood there like,
"Teach your kid better manners.
I'm here. I'm happy to talk. I'm happy to tell you all to fuck off. I can do it individually, or I can do it as a group. I do group discounts." Anyway,
all right. Number.
Have you given away your third movie already?
I said it was Kevin Costner.
Okay.
You seem to have a guess. I don't think you're going to guess.
Okay, right. Kevin Costner has done a crazy amount of good, a crazy amount of great, and a crazy amount of awful films.
Yes.
Right? I have probably two movies of his that I think are exceptionally good. One I mentioned earlier, No Way Out. Which, if you've never read the book it's based on, what a book that is. It's called The Big Clock. And if you're ordering it, don't mispronounce the name.
Yes. Oh, they made The Big Clock.
They did, yes.
Yeah,
I think No Way Out might be the third iteration.
I've seen this. It is good.
The book is brilliant. By Kenneth Fearing, if I remember right. No Way Out, I think, is a really good movie. It's not as good as the book, but it is really good. And it's got, obviously, Gene Hackman and that other dude whose name's gone clean out of my head. The Untouchables is just gloriously fantastic. Wildly over the top. I mean, fucking Armani doing the costumes. Come on. But Andy Garcia is brilliant. Sean Connery is hilarious as an Irishman.
The Odessa Steps tribute is nice. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking while we were talking about Leni Riefenstahl earlier, I was thinking if you combine Riefenstahl and Eisenstein, you've got the following 100 years of film language just right there. But De Palma isn't always so obvious with his, you might call them homages, you might say, he's a hack. I don't know.
It's
maybe I land somewhere in the middle.
I don't know why we give Scorsese the pass and we don't give De Palma the pass for just ripping off and remaking.
De Palma's made more shitty films than Scorsese.
Yeah, that's fair. Has.
When De Palma's bad, he's really bad.
That is true.
The Fury was fucking awful.
Oh, I have a soft spot for The Fury.
Well, I've got a soft spot for the helicopter scene.
Yeah, like, I'm not a big Scorsese person, I'll be honest.
I'm not. I don't regard him as a god, But when he's good, he is really good. But it, my favorite Scorsese movies are not the usual.
Mine is Hugo.
Okay, I've heard wonderful things about it, but I haven't seen it yet.
I really like Hugo. But...
I loved King of Comedy.
Oh, I know.
But my absolute favorite is After Hours.
I don't know if I ever got around to that one.
I think that's a really exceptional. Because, like, getting black comedy just right.
Yeah. I'm just like, these are movies for dudes. You know? Everybody's going to parade out Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
yeah, that was a while ago.
Like, Killers of the Flower Moon, if you read that book and decided the most interesting person in it was the dopey husband married to the woman with all the land, like, therein lies your problem.
I've not seen it. I've not actually seen a Scorsese film for...
You're not missing much.
...decades.
But see, here's my thing is, like De Palma and then Oliver Stone, too, JFK, that's a great... Costner movie. I think when Oliver Stone hits, it's so much better than Scorsese that I don't mind, like, and same with De Palma. The ones I love of De Palma, I really love, whereas every Scorsese movie, I'm just kind of like, eh.
I think De Palma is often much more interesting, and Oliver Stone. Much more interesting.
But then when they miss, it's wildly off.
Yeah, but they go for it.
Yeah.
They are basically tin cup. And I love that approach.
Yeah.
I do. I really
respect
that. I
thought you were referencing another Kevin Costner movie there for a second.
I was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because at the end of Tin Cup, he could...
Oh, yes. I get what you're saying.
He takes the audacious shot and he fucks up.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert. But that's what De Palma's movies often feel like. When he's good, he's phenomenal.
But again, when he's bad, you know right away that it's not... You're just bad. In concept alone, this is not working.
There are a lot of directors like that. I think Dario Argento is like
that. Yeah.
When he's good, his films are extraordinary. When he's bad, they're a mess.
Yeah.
They're like he's actually taken a shit on some film. that's what you get. I mean, I can't think of many, even John Carpenter's made shitty films.
Yeah. No, nobody's perfect. You know, nobody's perfect. But no, the Kevin Costner film, I wrote my essay to get into USC film school about this film. And when I got to film school, I found two others had as well, which was shocking to me.
Do I get another clue?
It's the same era as the movies you're talking about.
About 86, 87. Maybe
88. Untouchables, I think, was 90.
No, it was way earlier.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Well, not way earlier. It was probably 88. Although, I might be wrong, but I was working in a video shop in 1990, and it didn't have a new release number. God, I can still remember the number.
I worked at Blockbuster for several years, and similarly, I know... Like, from the era that I worked there, I remember every movie cover there is. You know, every movie poster. But, so yeah, this is 90s Costner.
Well, his big moment was Dances with Wolves. But I get the feeling you're not talking about that. You're not talking about an obvious one. The movie that you could write the most about is arguably Waterworld.
I of the flops, I actually find The Postman interesting and enjoyable.
I read the book, and I still can't for the life of me think why somebody thought it was a good idea
like,
to make the film.
It was flawed, but like, you've got some great performances in there.
Yeah, it's a very earnest film.
Lawrence Tate is great. Will Patton, who I always am happy to see pop up in things.
That's what I was trying to remember. Will Patton from No Way Out.
Will Patton's
brilliant in No
Way
Out. He's good in everything.
Well, he narrated Train Dreams, which had me hopeful, and then I hated that movie.
Okay, I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's so boring.
Just because it just sounded shit.
Yeah, no, it's super boring.
I don't know.
Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Fucking hell.
I actually will make the argument, I think this is about as perfect an action movie in terms of appealing to in a four-quadrant way as you're going to get. And again, Desert Island. If I want something that's a little bit funny.
Oh, Tropical Island, just in case.
Oh, yeah, Tropical Island, yeah. I want something that's a little bit funny. I want a little bit of romance. I want a little bit of action. I want, you know, a little bit of, like, a like just real high camp from Alan Rickman.
Yeah.
Which is just...
He does nail it.
It just has a little bit of... You got a heartthrob in Christian Slater. You got, you know...
It does have a lot.
Morgan Freeman turning in...
Yeah. And a very fine British cast.
It's one of those that, like, it's eminently watchable to me. I've seen it 700 times. I almost didn't pick it because, again, I could probably act out the entire thing for you, start to finish.
It's interesting. I mean, what was it?
But it's just so, like I said, if I'm going to watch something over and over, I want to be able, it's going to cover a lot of genres for me.
I think it was Kevin Reynolds' second film. I think his first film was
Kevin Beast Reynolds is an under. He is a journeyman kind of one that, because he doesn't have like an auteur vibe at all, doesn't get as much credit as he should.
Well, it'd have been interesting if he hadn't made Waterworld, where his career would have gone.
Yeah.
Just like with Michael Lehman, I wonder what would have happened to him if he hadn't made Hudson Hawk.
Yeah.
Which was actually a really fun film. But I get where you're coming from with Prince.
Keep in mind, too, I was 8.
Did
when
you
I
see
saw
it at
this
cinema?
Movie,
you see it at the
I saw it at the cinema, and then it was one of those. There was an era here where every Christmas at McDonald's there were 3 VHS tapes that you could buy on discount for like $5 or something,
okay,
with your meals. And one of the years it was Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, so we had it on video. Okay. And like Christian Slater was one of my like. My first crush was technically Donatello, the Ninja Turtle. My first human celebrity crush was Christian Slater.
He was one of mine as well. And I mentioned Michael Lehman because, of course, I think... I've got kind of 3 favorite movies, and Heathers is joint top. I think it's an extraordinary film.
Yeah, like, I just like, you know, there's an edge to him. The Jack Nicholson-esque-ness of him.
Yeah, yeah. Without that, I think the young Nicholson, especially looking at like 5 Easy Pieces and things like that, I think there's a real bastard about him, and I don't think Slater had that. I don't think he came across in a.
He wasn't quite asshole.
He was a bad boy, but he didn't come across as an asshole.
He could do like flawed, you know. He could do troubled. I don't think Jack ever really did troubled. It was always like kind of sinister.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
But he just reminds me a lot of Jack Nicholson, the voice and face shape a little bit.
These days, when I think of Jack Nicholson, I can't help thinking of the Robert Evans autobiography, The Kid Stays in the Picture, and just this description of going around to Nicholson's house when they're trying to get the 2 Jakes made, I think it is, and him being just really grateful that Jack comes out in his robe because he's suffering terribly with hemorrhoids. It's like, I bet Nicholson read that and thought, Bob, you absolute twat.
So one of my favorite bands is the Monkees, and I love the Jack Nicholson connection to that.
Come on, what is
he wrote the Monkees movie. He wrote Head.
Okay, yeah, he was Corman and all of that, wasn't he, Nicholson?
Rafeson. He was friends with Bob Rafeson.
Right. It's just that there's a really strange bit like prior to that 1970s famous, oh my God, nobody knows anything period where... you've got like Corman and all of those.
Oh, and he's the protege for all of them. I am currently reading The Last Kings of Hollywood, which is Coppola, Lucas, okay, Spielberg, and so you've got all those stories of who's the last picture show guy?
Uh-oh. If you hadn't asked me that, I'd have just known it.
I'm like, girlfriend murdered, Playboy model. Oh my God, why don't I know his name? Bogdanovich. Peter Bogdanovich.
Yeah,
now, he was a Corman guy, too.
He was a Corman guy, as was Bill Paxton.
Oh, Bill.
Oh. Bill Paxton's one of those guys where I wonder what his career would have held, because he was showing up as a director that could tell a story.
Oh, he was doing some interesting stuff there at the end.
But I mean, frailty is glorious.
True story, I'm not allowed to watch that movie. My mom made me promise.
Wow.
No, Frequency. Frequency is what I'm thinking of, not Frailty.
Okay, yeah, they're very different films.
Yeah, no, Frequency, I'm not... So my dad died when I was young, issues around it, and she saw this movie, and I was a teenager when it came out.
That's the people communicating through static and all
my
that.
My dad was like a ham radio guy, obsessed with ham radio, and she was just like, I know you. You can't see this movie. I can't deal with the emotional collapse that will ensue if you see this movie. So just promise never to watch it.
Okay. Yeah, I can. That would make sense. Yeah. It's.
But no, Frailty is a good movie. Yeah.
Frailty's fabulous.
Well, I'm gonna, in the same vein of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, action movies. They don't make them this way anymore. Twister, another basically perfect action movie to me. You have a fun ensemble cast, little bit of humor. Really good action set pieces.
Cow.
There's a story. Cow. Campy villain.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting watching
Back in my day, they made... These are just the kind of action movies I enjoy, because I'm not a comic book person.
But the sequel, it's looking
at
the
two... It was interesting.
Looking at the two, you have a really good illustration of how movies have evolved, because the second movie is a box-ticking exercise. The studios have been trying to make a leading man out of that dude who is never going to be
Glenn
a leading
Powell?
Man.
Oh, no, I love a Glenn Powell movie.
Nah, does nothing for me.
It's the girl, Daisy Edgar Jones, and I'm just like, I don't know why you keep trying to make this girl famous. I
love
Glenn Powell.
So I watched, on the flight to Vegas, I watched
The Running Man. Liked it more than I expected to.
I liked it a lot more than I expected to, but I still couldn't help sitting there and thinking, why are they trying to make this guy do angry?
Yeah, he's a little miscast in there. Like, he's so charming. Anyone But You, that rom-com, I think that's him. That and, what is it? The one where he's the hired gun,
Oh, yeah, I've also not seen that, because fuck that guy.
Oh, I like him.
I think he's a charisma vacuum. I don't doubt that he's a lovely guy.
Oh, I find him very, like, charming.
But he's just, he's very one-dimensional to me. He just...
I like it. I do like in Twisters, they never kiss. I like that choice. I was sitting there going, this is interesting.
Yeah.
And realistic, you know, like...
Well...
But yeah, Twister, like...
Twisters just felt like... Let's do this. It's got to have this. It's got to have this. It's got to have this. It's like when AI makes its first movie, it's going to be Twisters.
Yeah. No, whereas you think about like the first one, they're just like, okay, let's give Jan de Bont the speed guy. You know what would be some cool action set pieces? Tornadoes. And they started there, but then it's like, let's actually write what ended up being like a pretty good script, I'll be honest.
It's got Bill Paxton in.
There's so many good lines. Like, I gotta go. We got cows.
Honestly, Paxton's one of those actors I would watch him in anything. And I have watched him in some real shit.
Twister 2, first movie where I said, who's that guy? And the answer was Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Wow. I think Philip Seymour Hoffman's lasting gift to popular culture is basically... the word shart.
Okay, wow.
Yeah. I think it's... I think the movie was Along Came Polly, something like
that. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he says shart in it, and he has to explain it. And, like, that was the first time I ever heard the word shart. And I've been using it ever since, and I believe the rest of the world has too.
Yeah.
So, God bless you, Philip Seymour Hoffman. Safe
journey.
But no,
I think a lot of people my age, at least in the States, we hadn't seen him in anything. Really. Okay. And then Twister was, we were like, that guy who played Rusty was fun.
I can't remember the first place I saw him. Maybe it was Twister. Yeah, maybe, maybe. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, though, fucking hell.
I know. I feel like I especially offend British people because Robin Hood has an American accent and a mullet, but like...
No, it was huge. Huge
in Britain. I mean, that was a top 10 movie of the year, too.
Plus...
And then they remake Robin Hood all these over and over, and I'm like, why keep trying to do this?
It's not really a controversy, but the Bryan Adams song.
So good.
It was number one for 4 months in the UK. Bryan Adams eventually said, fuck this. Let's just stop
just
selling
take
it.
Me out, yeah.
And it was 16 weeks at number one.
That's a great song.
And that was when it was quite difficult to get to number one. It's unreal. And even now when I hear it, I get a tear in my eye. It just hurts so much to hear that fucking song again. You've got one song that's not on the albums.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
I mentioned I Am an Emo Girl. There is a song that kind of made the rounds when I was in college amongst emo girls by Something Corporate. We talked about Andrew McMahon. It's 9 minutes long. It's called Constantine with a K. And it is just this like fever dream, piano, emo, meandering song that ends with like a ridiculously emotional bridge. So yeah, it's just the when I want to feel sad for 9 minutes, I'm going to listen to this song.
Wow.
Yeah.
9 minutes of sadness is a lot.
I'm that person, like the people who are like, oh, if you're sad, watch a happy movie. I'm like, no. Like, if I'm sad about being, like, lonely, I'm going to put on Marty.
Yeah, I'm one of those people. I tend to lean into it.
I just want to, I want to get, you know, I need a catharsis for it that's, like, semi-healthy.
Can I give you a hot tip, though, right? My favorite melancholy music is the album Sleep by Max Richter.
Okay.
It's 8.5 hours long.
Oh. Wait, is Max Richter the one that's the end of Hamnet?
Don't know. I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's that one. It's like, it was in Arrival 2, I think. They're like, it's that melancholy music they put in everything. Oh, what is it called?
It might be from Sleep.
No, it's going to bother me. And I don't know where
I'm going to. I'm going to look it up live while we record.
Yeah, end of Hamnet song.
Well, he did the score. This film score is composed by Max Richter.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know she did Nomadland. Interesting.
Oh, Chloe Dow, yeah. And The Eternals. Again, we go to They Can't All Be Winners.
Ah, you're talking about On the Nature of Daylight.
Yes.
Yeah, that's...
I was like, I think that's what you're talking about.
No, that's actually from the Blue Notebooks.
Oh.
Which is also sensational and has some Tilda Swinton on it.
Oh.
Blue Notebooks is fantastic, but Sleep is just it's fucking indescribably brilliant. Okay, so we got a song. What about a pet?
So this is tough. I wasn't really allowed to have pets as a child. So I've had a goldfish and a parakeet in my life, and both of them were kind of... I'd rather just, like, befriend a monkey on the island or something.
Well, look, Jen Bowman was one of the early episodes we did, right? And Jen had her stuffed toy that still travels everywhere with her. So I think we can be fairly fast and loose with this.
Oh, if... I had a Care Bear cousin, the ones that are not the bears, the various other animals, the Swiftheart rabbit... came with me everywhere. So yeah, he can come along. There we go. Because yeah, I was like, I would rather just like have like a monkey on the island that's a friend of mine, you know, that we have like a George of the Jungle kind of relationship.
But the monkeys will be your butlers.
Oh.
Yeah, definitely having monkey butlers.
Or, well, so like, he's not my pet, but I would take Punch, that monkey that went viral for like the IKEA orangutan that he thought was his mom.
No, I missed that.
Oh, okay.
I was probably busy being heartless somewhere.
Oh, it's very cute.
Yeah, but...
But yeah, like, not a pet person, which I feel like now when I say, like, I'm not a big dog person, I might as well say, like, I'm a serial killer.
Yeah, I stab cats, something like that.
Yeah, like, I like to... My mom, she grew up, like, picking cotton on a farm. Dogs were farm animals. They didn't even have names.
Yep.
So it was just like the idea of that was just not something that was in my mind as a child.
Yeah, it's fair enough. It's all right. Okay, so we've got your pet. What about you? Dessert? You're allowed an object.
Oh, an object. I feel like other people have picked this, a deck of cards.
I don't think anybody's picked a deck of cards.
Yeah, I'm going to bring up a deck of playing cards.
That's a good one. Any particular brand?
We'll go bicycle, you know, like a quality bicycle or maybe a Copag.
Wow. Now, I would have probably picked Fournier, but, you know, what can I say?
So bicycle started in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is why I'm like somewhat partial to them. And at the Cincinnati airport, there is a bicycle vending machine.
Of course there is. It's probably got a queue in front of it as we speak.
Well, one of my friends is like a big playing card enthusiast. And when he found out that they were unrolling these vending machines, he asked me, like, will you go for me? And I went like on a journey to find what was in the vending machine and bring him decks of cards.
Was he happy?
Very.
Okay. That's good. Slightly bizarre, but good.
Yeah.
But that's a really good choice for you.
No one's picked. I figured, like, gambling, somebody would just think, like, I just need a game. I need something.
No, I don't think anybody's picked a deck. I might be wrong. Maybe.
And then, you know, it's good for, like, counting and other various things. Yeah. I can find other objects or other ways to utilize it.
Okay. Dessert, the big one.
Oh, this is easy. I don't know cookie cake, the big chocolate chip cookie with frosting on it.
This sounds like an American thing.
Keeping with the theme. So yeah, cookie cake when I get married, I don't want cake, I want a cookie cake. So essentially, imagine like a 12-inch diameter chocolate chip cookie and like piped buttercream and chocolate frosting that's like, Happy Birthday, John, on it.
Okay.
Because, like, I don't get restaurant desserts very often, because every time I look at the menu, I say to myself, would I enjoy this more than a chocolate chip cookie from the mall? And the answer is almost always no.
Okay. I did accidentally have a bit of cheesecake last night.
I like cheesecake.
It was pretty good.
How did you accidentally consume it?
Well, the guy comes over. I was with Judge Cheryl, right? I was with Judge Moss, and she's like, the desserts here are pretty good. And I'm like, well, I'm not really doing desserts at the moment. And the chap comes over, Jonathan, the waiter, is a lovely fella. He comes over, and he says, John, what's your favorite dessert? I said, you won't have my favorite dessert.
Is it an eaten mess or something like that?
No, God no, it is quite unusual. And he pushed and pushed and pushed. And eventually I said, okay, look, my favorite dessert is ginger cheesecake.
Oh, that's a good combo.
It's phenomenal. The mother of my children, my ex, Fern, her dad is a food technologist. And I mentioned that somebody had made, myself and my ex-wife, Zoe, a friend of hers had made a ginger cheesecake and had some left over and gave us half of this ginger cheesecake, and it was like nothing I'd ever tasted. And I mentioned it to him, and he was like, challenge accepted, and he went away and just experimented until he made something he was really happy with. And Christmas Day one year, he turns up and he gives me this ginger cheesecake, and I'm just like, you realize I'm not sharing this with anybody, any
this
of
is mine.
And I ate the whole cheesecake, which is really bad. And he's like, no, it's for you. I'm like, good. And yeah, so Jonathan goes away and he comes back with a strawberry cheesecake.
Okay.
It's not the same thing.
Yeah, I was like, if cheesecake was the solution, you probably would have just been like, is there cheesecake on this menu?
As opposed to, I'm all right, thanks.
Yeah.
I'm not really doing sugar at the moment. The cheesecake comes out. And Judge Cheryl's like, you could just
have
a bit of it.
Now you have to take a bite, yeah.
Fuck, if I have one bite, I'm going to have the whole thing. And some of yours. And that is what happened. Oh. I had the whole thing and some of Judge Cheryl's creme brulee.
Okay.
Which is pretty decent.
Yeah. I'm very American in that desserts need chocolate in them.
Is that an American thing?
I don't know. But as someone who watches a lot of Bake Off, there does seem to be a lot less chocolate in the desserts happening.
Well, I think cream is a more essential ingredient in British desserts.
Yeah, I'm not a cream person at all. Custard is a concept. I'm out. No, thank you.
Wow.
The texture of it's kind of unpleasant.
Yeah, but I mean, we're in America and they call things pies and they're not fucking pies. It's a dessert, for fuck's sake. It's not a pie.
Oh, yeah. This is... Yeah, no, I love Bake Off, but like sometimes the very American in me makes me laugh when Paul is like, peanut butter and jam. Who thinks that's a combination that people would like? And I was just like, again, literally everybody.
No. Not us.
That's a great combination. It's tried and true.
No, not having it. But okay, you can have your cookie cake.
Yeah.
That brings us down to...
Oh, this is the tough part.
The advice. A lot of people do find this difficult. Because it's two directions.
Yeah.
But you choose when you receive this advice, right?
Oh, okay. I missed this part then.
Maybe I didn't tell you. But it's okay. You seem to be...
I'm prepared with answers.
Capable of thinking on your feet. So we'd usually start with advice from your older self to your younger self. And sometimes it's a specific, around a specific event. And sometimes it's very general. You know, people have gone in all sorts of directions with this. So what's your older self to younger self?
So this one, I tried, I was like, maybe I should be career focused. And I just couldn't come up with like a good one that didn't feel cheesy. So I'm going a bit personal here. I think when I was younger, I had this assumption that nobody knows you better than your family, you know?
Okay.
And I would tell my younger self, you're actually kind of funny. You know, like, people find the jokes you make amusing. They find, like, your perceptions funny. Because I'm not a stand-up comedian, but, like, I can be funny from time to time.
Okay.
Funny is the last word anyone in my family would use to describe me. Because it's just not their kind of humor at all. My mom didn't do sarcasm. She didn't do, like, the witty kind of humor. So I think it would just be, like, it's not, hey, you're funny. It's more... Just because they're your family doesn't mean they're the best judge of who you are.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Not least because it's true.
I think you just get in your head, like, if my own mom and dad don't think I'm very funny, how can I possibly be funny? You know? Or something like that. And the older I get, the more I realize, like, I had assets and things I was good at that I had just written off as impossible because my family didn't think that about me.
Yeah.
So yeah, it would just be like, your family doesn't know everything about you, would be the advice, I think.
Interesting. Okay. And the other way around, what could you learn from your younger self?
So this one was a lot harder.
Yes, it is.
But... up until probably like 2021, I never gave myself a break. I never let up. You know, like, I always just was like very driven, super type A. And I'm glad that I course corrected a bit. Like, I went to a pretty good college, like a top 25 university, and getting there and learning, you know, you're just a regular fish in this pond and there's no way you're going to be number one all the time was useful. But I had this moment in therapy where my therapist was like, you know, like, buy yourself a treat now and again. If you're having a hard time, you know, give yourself some me time and whatever. And I think the older people get, and maybe it's just me, but I think other people deal with this, the more you have the ability to kind of self-soothe and, okay, I can afford, you know, a couple glasses of wine or, you know, ordering something dumb on Amazon. I think younger me would be like, how about you just, like, live with the discomfort every once in a while? You don't have to self-soothe all the time. Because I think you can lean too much into it, you know?
No, it's very interesting because, the growth in interest in endurance sports across all demographics, but especially women, is remarkable. And certainly the early sort of pioneers in ultra running all used to basically say, look, we are built to struggle. That's what our bodies and our minds are good at. All of this comfort and all of this easy shit, that is not what humans, that's not what we do. That's not what we're engineered for. You know, we're engineered to store fat because we're engineered for scarcity of food for months at a time. We are, you know, we can endure all kinds. We have this amazing elasticity in our brains to accept things that we would assume would break us at other times. You know, and actually learning and growth come from things being shit.
Yeah, like, I mean, there's a balance for sure. You know, it was good to learn.
Things are shit all the time. That's not great.
But, I mean, you kind of look at, as someone who's in, you know, the responsible and problem gambling space, there's all these comorbidities with addiction, anxiety, alcoholism, depression, etc. And not a therapist, not licensed, but at the core of it is people just trying to, like, medicate themselves.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if I can turn that back off again. You know, it's like when you're your first apartment and you're like, my furniture's inflatable, the mattress is on the floor, and that's fine. But then you get to be 40 and you're just like, how much extra do I have to pay at this concert to go to the bathroom faster? You know, you just get used to paying for these comforts and it's hard to go back. I think it's the same thing with, like, I've had a shit day, so I'm allowed to have, you know, 3 glasses of wine.
But what's interesting in what you're saying there is,
maybe just have a shit day and be like, that's a bummer. And tomorrow we'll hope that it's better. But I think we kind of condition ourselves once you start doing this, like, what will make me feel better? They become really, really tied.
So I've been sober for, I think, 8 years, coming up 8 years.
Congrats.
Thank you. Never diagnosed with alcoholism, but had a highly abusive relationship with alcohol for a long time. And I know a lot of addicts. My situation is not the same as theirs, and I'm not trying to equate it to it. But what I can equate is that, you know, you say, like, you can't necessarily go back, but actually, when an addict does give up that destructive thing, it is a massive jump. Well, it's kind of a jump back and a jump forwards, away from that harmful thing. And pretty much every alcoholic I know says the same thing. They would not willingly go back to how it was because they want the clarity of just being here and being alive. And all of the shit that comes with that. Because actually that's way better than all of that numbing and self-soothing that you were doing. For, you know, all kinds of complex reasons. And, I was just, while you were talking, I was just thinking about how addiction, it is a reset. And that's why I think recovery in an awful lot of spaces is so difficult, because you are learning or relearning, but sometimes learning for the first time, ways to live without those crutches.
Yeah.
And that's enormously difficult, especially when your whole fucking social life might be built around that. Yeah. All of your key relationships might be built around that. Your entire family relationship might be built around that thing.
Yeah.
And it's this huge step, and it's terrifying. It's interesting. Sorry, you just sparked some sort of thoughts.
No, I mean, like, yeah, as I was thinking about this one, I'm like, there's a lot to unpack here, and I'll probably keep mulling over it for a while. But, like, I feel like culturally, too, it's like, it might, to me, it feels like a bit of an overcorrection, because I was born and raised by, or I was raised by, you know, like really repressive Catholics, but like the mental health days and me time and these cushionings, like, I'm glad that you're normalizing needing to take a mental health break, because like there are certainly times and places, but I do feel like I kind of get caught up in the, like, you should never have to be uncomfortable, which it goes back to like the Leni Riefenstahl of it all, right? There are people now that don't want to watch movies or read books from people who disagree with them.
Yeah, or subjects that make them feel uncomfortable.
And it's like, those are, I think as someone who has always been very like centrist and moderate in my thinking, I've always either been the extreme left wing to my right wing family or the extreme right wing to my left wing friends. And I kind of have never felt like anybody was really talking my language, that I'm very comfortable consuming things from people I disagree with, because there just doesn't feel like there's a lot of people I agree with out there.
Yeah.
But a lot of my friends, younger friends, they just don't want to, they don't want the discomfort that comes with it. And they feel like they shouldn't ever have to address it. And I'm like, again, if that's how you want to live your life, go for it.
But we're in a world where there is such a profound, disturbing lack of critical thinking.
Yeah.
And understanding of context, et cetera, et cetera. And that's some scary shit. And that's on every side of any spectrum you can think of. Like, everybody's doing this shit and they're not taking a second to think. Like, so this is going to sound like a strange example, right? But my kids, they're always asking me about horror movies. They know I love horror movies.
Yeah.
And they'll talk about The Exorcist like it's the scariest movie ever made. And they'll be like, have you seen The Exorcist? Yeah. Yeah, of course.
It's crossed my path.
Was it scary? I'm like, not really, no. Did you like it? Not especially. I really didn't. I really enjoyed the book. And the book is so much about Father Karras' loss of faith. And the movie doesn't go deeply into that.
Yeah.
And it's completely the heart
of the
book. The
Exorcist feels a little... I've always felt like it, I've never quite gotten what the big deal with it was.
But
that I try to give it credit time and place.
I think context is everything to understand the movie's cultural impact and to understand why it is looked on the way that it is. And I've tried to explain this to the kids. Like, from a technical perspective, The Exorcist is one of the most extraordinary films that's ever been made.
Because it's all practical.
It's unbelievably well made. I mean, it's stunning. Imagine if they'd left the spider walk in. Like, people would have fucking died in the cinema.
Yeah.
Because, like, when I saw the spider walk for the first time, she comes down. It's so beautifully done. It's so wrong. It's so utterly wrong. And the two versions of the tongue in it as well. It's just fucked up. Now, that impressed the hell out of me. And part of me is glad they left it out. Because in 1973?
Something like that, yeah.
That would have blown people's minds. It would have just destroyed
people.
Well,
I mean, you know, like the first movies, people thought a train was going to run through the building.
Totally.
Because you just don't... You're just like, ah!
Because there's no context for it. And I've tried to explain to the kids the point of The Exorcist, why The Exorcist is The Exorcist, is because nobody had ever seen anything like that before.
Yeah.
It had not been done before. A horror movie had not been made like that before. It was an absolute phenomenon. Everybody was talking about it. Churches were protesting it. But trying to give my kids who live in this world today that context, like, I was trying to explain to them about Madonna's, like, I have playlists, I put them in the car, shit that I like to sing along to. My kids are probably sick of these songs. Like a Prayer comes on.
Oh, God, I love that song.
What a song. And my daughter's like, is this Madonna? I'm like, yes, it is. Previously, they probably only had Beautiful Stranger or Live to Tell, right? But they're sharp kids. Is this Madonna? Yeah. And I started trying to tell them the story of how in the UK... the video was not allowed to be shown before 9 o'clock at night. Why? What's in it? Is it really rude or something? No.
But the guy from Cool Runnings plays Jesus.
Jesus in the video is black. What's wrong with that? That's a great question, kids.
No, that was like one of the first music videos I remember as a child, because it was 89, right? So I would have been five or six. Yeah.
And of course, I mean, when the Bad video was shown, that was shown at fucking midnight or something. And that was, of course, Scorsese directing that.
No, I mean, like, just music videos in general. Just the idea of, like, I remember my sister and I being like, November Rain is on! Get in the living room! Like...
Yeah, they were events. Well, let's not forget. So I don't know whether this is the same in the US. I suspect it probably is. But Thriller, which was Thriller and the making of Thriller, was the biggest selling videotape ever.
Oh, that's, yeah.
Beyond all of the Disney stuff. And bear in mind, all those Disney tapes were only on sale for 6 months.
The clamshells back in the day, yeah.
But back Thriller in the vault. Outsold everything. And earlier as well, when videos were not cheap. And that's really extraordinary. So context is everything. And ignoring context and ignoring history and not learning lessons and not understanding where things come from, especially when it concerns language and language that is, if you look at the way that social media is being used now to sway people, to feed people's ideas.
To give them exactly what they want to read, you know.
But everything Riefenstahl was doing ties into that, everything. Yeah. And so to not learn from that is absolute madness. And there's nothing prejudicial about it. It doesn't make you a fucking Nazi to watch Leni Riefenstahl. It makes you a Nazi if you think, oh, this is a good idea.
Yeah.
That, totally.
Like, if you're just like, the words being said speak to me. Yeah, that's disconcerting.
Your work will set you free. That's very wise.
No, I have two nephews. One is 20... Oh, God, he's 24 at this point. And the younger one is going to be 17 next month. I tried so hard with movies and with dinner and with everything. They would get really annoyed because I would always say, question one, did you like it? Question two, what did you like about it? And they're like, why do you always ask that? And I was like, if you can't conquer the simple task of being able to identify why you do and do not like something, how are you ever going to be discerning about anything?
Yep. My daughter's answer to everything is, I don't know. I'm like...
Yeah, they're always just like, I don't know, I liked it. And I was just like, how? I mean, as someone who I can give, 10 minutes about the worst movie I've ever seen, I can give 10 minutes about the best movie I've ever seen, and a long list of reasons. Like, some of it is just, I don't understand that headspace. But I do think, like, that skill set of being able to communicate, here's why I like something.
Yeah.
Here's why I dislike something. I don't know where you learn it anymore.
This is the real basics. This is the absolute fundamentals of it.
But it's like, I mean, it's not like, I couldn't tell you, like, where in the lesson plan. First grade is when we teach them how to have opinions. Yeah. You know, like, it's not baked into education. And because teachers, I don't envy them, are put in this spot where, like, they certainly can't get anywhere near something, near an opinion, without somebody getting all riled up. How are you ever going to teach people to have one?
Yeah. Although it's being said that I might have too many. Maybe I'll start renting them out. Rent my opinions out.
Blockbuster opinions. Come rent them. Due by midnight, 3 days later.
What are you talking? Or maybe rent them out for a week at a time. And the more controversial ones will be much cheaper, obviously. They're all probably controversial. Jessica, I'm going to hit stop there. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been a very interesting conversation.